Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, August 19th. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from Upstate Dermatology. For more than 30 years, a medical team providing diversified dermatologic services, including medical, surgical, and cosmetic, 5 locations in the Capital Region and serving Western Massachusetts. UpstateDerm.com. Joining us today is Dr. David Penn of New Vance Health. Dr. Penn is a neurosurgeon with areas of expertise, including treatment of complex brain tumors, such as acoustic neuromas and meningiomas, vascular malformations, aneurysms, cerebral bypass. He specializes in minimally invasive endoscopic treatments for pituitary tumors and other types of brain tumors. Call early, 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Back after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us for this Medical Monday is Dr. David Penn of New Vance Health. Dr. Penn is a neurosurgeon with areas of expertise, including treatment of complex brain tumors such as acoustic neuromas and meningiomas, vascular malformations such as aneurysms and AVMs, and cerebral bypass. He specializes in minimally invasive endoscopic treatments for pituitary tumors and other types of brain tumors. If you have a question for Dr. Penn, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org with your question, voxpop@wamc.org, or 800-348-2551. Dr. David Penn, welcome back to the show. How are you?
Thank you for having me. It's great to be back.
Yeah, it's been a while now. How long was it? Last year you were
close
on?
Close to a year.
Yeah, so great to have you here. Let's start out talking about something I know very little, which is most things, come to think of it. pituitary gland. Two questions. One, you know, there are endocrine surgeons, and the pituitary gland is a gland. Why is this in your specialty?
Sure, that's a great question. So, depending on how much high school biology you remember, the pituitary gland is kind of like the master endocrine gland, and it releases a lot of hormones throughout the entirety of the body that control things like metabolism, growth, sexual function, energy levels, all those kind of things. And although it functions, you know, very integrally in our endocrine function, it's actually located underneath the brain. And because of this, we can actually access it through the nose. So we can take approaches where we work through the nose to take out the tumor. And there are a lot of important structures that live around the pituitary gland. So as these tumors start to grow, it can affect things like our vision, our pituitary function, a whole lot of symptoms.
But it's in the head. And so therefore, it's your domain.
Correct.
So it's a union thing.
It is a union thing. That's true. Now, the other interesting thing about that surgery is we actually do it. It's a multidisciplinary surgery. So because we take an approach working through the nose, I do all of these surgeries with a fellowship-trained otolaryngologist or a nose specialist.
Yeah.
So the otolaryngologist helps us gain access to the tumor at the brain by working through the nose. So it's actually, you know, you draw those lines of which union owns what. Yeah,
there are no
it's
real unions,
more
complicated. Though, right?
No, there's no,
okay.
no real unions.
It was
union.
Only a joke.
But it's more complicated than it seems, sure.
So interesting. And the pituitary gland does so much. Mm-hmm. And surgery, before endoscopic surgery, it must have been quite an ordeal.
Correct. So the old way we used to do this surgery is we'd make a big incision on the head, open up a window of bone, lift up the brain to get out the tumor. But now, because of all the development of technology, again, we can work with endoscopes, which, one, allow us to avoid an incision. It allows us to work directly within the tumor, as opposed to crossing important structures and putting those structures at risk. And ultimately, patients just feel a lot better the next day with a surgery that goes through the nose, as opposed to a surgery that involves the brain.
Are outcomes better over the long run?
So if you look at the research, the outcomes are actually about the same.
Mm-hmm.
But something that I tell patients that I know because I see the various types of things, patients who have had a nose surgery just look and feel a lot better than patients who have had a brain surgery. And while I like to think our brain surgery patients do very well, it's a subtle difference.
Well, if you are a patient and you have this procedure endoscopically, are you out of the hospital much or quicker than you are if you have a section of your head removed?
It's actually still about the same.
Really?
Patients who have pituitary surgery, one of the things we worry about is their salt and water balance. So we usually keep them in the hospital watching their sodium levels, how much they're drinking, how much they're going to the bathroom. We usually watch them in the hospital for 2 days, and if everything kind of checks out, we can get them out.
How big is a pituitary gland?
The pituitary gland itself is under a centimeter, I'd say.
And you can get a tumor on there.
You can remove
that tumor.
Correct.
You cannot, or can you, remove the entire pituitary gland?
You can remove the entire pituitary gland, and there are situations where the tumors are so invasive that we have to do that. If we do remove the entire pituitary gland, we usually have to replace the hormones that that pituitary gland makes, which, depending on the types of tumors, the effects it's having on patients, even those add medications to patients' lives, sometimes the benefits of having the whole gland out and replacing those hormones outweigh the risks of not having that tumor involved.
We're joined today by Dr. David Penn of New Vance Health. Dr. Penn is a neurosurgeon. Number is 800-348-2551. If you have a question, 800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. We talked a little about the symptoms of a pituitary tumor. Is this one of those silent cancers that you don't know about until it's almost too late?
So one of the very important things about pituitary tumors is they're almost always benign, meaning not cancerous, unlikely to go to the liver or lungs or things like that. The problems they cause are almost twofold. One type of pituitary tumor can over-secrete certain hormones, which can cause downstream medical effects that cause weight gain, joint problems, changes in your facial features, hand size, shoe size, things like that. That's one reason a pituitary tumor may need to come out. Other types of tumors actually don't secrete any hormones, and they cause problems by growing bigger, and they can put pressure on the structures that surround them. The pituitary gland, which can cause decreased endocrine function, or more importantly, it can put pressure on the nerves that control vision. So people can present with vision loss. And that's one of the big reasons we tend to take those out, to try to reverse that vision loss. And the good news is they're generally slow-growing tumors, so we're usually very capable of reversing the vision loss, just as long as we get to it in a timely fashion.
We're joined by Dr. David Penn today on this edition of Medical Monday. The number is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. In the intro, I said that you will do cerebral bypass from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm somewhat, in a very loose and probably inaccurate way, familiar with heart bypass.
Mm-hmm.
Cerebral bypass, to me, it sounds like you're bypassing the brain.
Correct.
Wait a minute. All right. You got to give me a quick explanation of that.
Sure. So sometimes patients can develop clogs in their arteries, similar to what you think about the heart. Oftentimes, we can manage these medically with medications like aspirin and Plavix and prevent them from having strokes. But if that blockage gets severe enough and they're really at high risk for stroke, what we can actually do is oftentimes we take the blood vessel that runs to the scalp, and what we'll do is we'll sew that into the blood vessel that feeds the brain. So you bypass that blockage, allowing the brain to get the blood that it needs.
Yeah, I see. The number here is 800-348-2551. Tell you what, Zach the engineer, let's take a break here. Dr. David Penn is our guest. It's neurosurgery today. If you have a question, now's your chance. 800-348-2551. Great John Schofield on the bumper music there. Trio Blues, 800-348-2551. That's our phone number. It's Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you. We're joined today by Dr. David Penn of New Vance Health, who unfortunately got poured upon. Their brain must have started just as you pulled in the parking lot.
Very true. That's okay.
For that, I apologize. Hey, before we get off of this topic of pituitary tumors, a couple questions come to mind. One, what causes them? And is there any sort of measures one can take, lifestyle, to keep them at bay?
It's a great question. The ultimate answer is no. We don't know what causes them. Obviously, the cells within the pituitary gland are constantly dividing and turning over, producing hormones. And inevitably, what happens is they get a mutation in the genes that help keep them in check. And once they're out of check, basically, these cells can overgrow and they start to form these masses.
Yeah.
We don't know of any direct causation for these tumors. You know, the example I use is if you're a smoker and you develop lung cancer, we know that smoking causes that.
Good chance that had something to do with it.
But as far as brain tumors go, no, we don't have a direct causation. So it's not the cell phones. It's not living too close to the power lines or standing near the microwave. Certainly none of those things are good for us. But we don't know that these directly cause any of these tumors that we see in the brain.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. David Penn is our guest from New Vance Health. The fact that most of these are benign, does that give you a clue at all about causation?
It doesn't really. You know, the brain and tumors in the brain are complex, and the brain has a lot of the blood vessels of the brain are designed very specially to not let certain things in and not let certain things out. So that's part of why stuff that starts in the brain tends to not go to the rest of the body. But again, normally these tumors cause their problems by growing and putting pressure on things as opposed to going to other places in the body. So,
All right. I'm sorry. One more question before we go to the phones.
It's okay.
Explain briefly the blood-brain barrier and how you get around that when you have to go in and do surgery.
So for us, the blood-brain barrier is at a molecular level. So the cells within the blood vessels of the brain are designed differently, and they actually have what we call tight junctions, meaning the space between those cells blocks molecules from going in and out of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
So ultimately, the blood-brain barrier doesn't change how we do surgery. What the blood-brain barrier really changes is how we deliver medications to the brain. So getting chemo, you know, if we go to the cancer subject, right, getting chemotherapy to other spots in the body is easier because those blood vessels allow more things to go back and forth and attack those cancer cells.
Right.
Where the brain is not wired like that.
Okay. How do you do it? Do you put a needle right in the brain?
So a lot of brain tumors get treated with radiation therapy more commonly than a chemotherapy.
No, but I mean, how do you get medications through the blood-brain barrier if it is pretty much not even a semi-permeable membrane, but just you can't get in there? But I assume there are times when you would want to do some sort of drug or chemo or something. How do you get it in?
So unfortunately right now, a lot of chemotherapies don't work very well going into the brain. There is research out there developing various transport techniques at a very basic level. Some people are wrapping medications in lipid membranes that do cross the blood-brain barrier.
Interesting.
So it goes through the cell in the blood vessel, and then the body degrades that membrane and releases the medication.
Wild. Now, when you do it that way, though, is it controllable enough? Can you be specific as to where you are targeting that?
It's very hard. And a lot of this is earlier research as opposed to things that we're using really in practice.
Dr. David Penn is our guest today from New Vance Health. Let's hit the phones. I've delayed it long enough. 800-348-2551 is the number. Ashley is in Sunderland. Ashley, go ahead.
Hi, I'm asking about history and then about today. My grandfather was a pituitary giant. That is, he had a very elongated jaw and large hands. And he died in the 1920s of pneumonia was the immediate cause, but he had numerous health issues, I think, that were related to his pituitary issues. And his wife, my grandmother, had a brain tumor, and she died in the 1950s. And she had a blood clotting deficiency. And my understanding is that the brain tumor was operable, but she couldn't have surgery because of her blood clotting deficiency. My question is, how would these situations be handled in 2024, if you wouldn't mind hazarding a guess?
Sure. So in patients, it sounds like you're describing that your grandfather had acromegaly.
That's correct.
So in 2024, we would actually treat that surgery, treat that tumor via an endoscopic approach, meaning that we work with cameras through the nose to get to the back of the back of the nose and work within the sinuses that you think about when you get a sinus infection. And there's a small amount of bone that lives in the very back of the nose on these sinuses that we can actually open up and work directly within the tumor to take it out. So in general, for acromegaly, the first line treatment is considered surgery, because if we can take all of that tumor out, in general, what we can do is decrease those growth hormone levels significantly enough that we could potentially cure the patient. Unfortunately, our cameras are still only so good. We can't resolve down to a cellular level. So there's always a risk that these tumors can come back. But what we've seen is that there's probably about a 60 to 70% cure rate in patients with acromegaly when we get the tumors out.
Wow.
You know, with your grandmother, blood clotting disorders are certainly a challenge that we encounter in neurosurgery, in particular, because the analogy that we use is the skull is a locked box. So patients who have risks of bleeding or risks of blood clots, you know, if you have a bleed after a brain surgery, that can become devastating. So we generally, you know, we work very closely with a lot of other teams, our hematologists, our medical doctors, to treat any underlying clotting or bleeding disorders so that we can do surgery safely. Certainly all of medical technology has changed pretty drastically in 70 years. So my hope would be in today's day and age, we'd be able to treat that tumor. But again, it all depends on a lot of factors.
All right, Ashley, thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551 is our number. VoxPop@WAMC.org is the email address. If you have a question for Dr. David Penn today from New Vance Health, let's go to Newton, New Jersey. Diane, you're on.
Hi. I have a question. I was diagnosed probably a good 6 years or so. I went in for a problem with my eye, and they did an MRI, and it came back. The eye was good and remarkable, and I was told I have Dulles syndrome.
What was that?
Do you know what that is?
Say it again, Diane.
It's called Sella syndrome.
Empty Sella syndrome?
Yes. That's what they told me I had. And that's, they described it to me as my pituitary gland was flattened.
Yes.
How does it get flattened?
That's a great question. Sometimes people are just born like that, and it has that appearance on the pictures that we get. Sometimes that can be caused if you have elevated pressure within the brain for a number of reasons. Ultimately, I'm assuming if your doctor's looked into your endocrine function and all your hormones are functioning well, usually we don't need to do any surgery for that. It would just be something. In some ways, it can almost become just a little bit of a birthmark that you have on your brain. You were born a little bit differently. And if it's not causing you any symptoms, it wouldn't be something that you need a surgery for or anything that we would have to do about that.
Diane.
Well, I had a few concussions, so I don't know if it was from years ago when I had, an accident and maybe something transpired years later when I was complaining, you know, about my eye. Mm-hmm. And but then how would I know that, like, currently? I would have to get another MRI?
So you could get another MRI to make sure that nothing's changed within the pituitary gland. But I think in your case, what would probably be the most important thing to know is how well your pituitary gland is functioning. And we do that through blood work.
Okay.
And if all your hormone function is normal, again, I don't think, you know, there's anything that you need to worry about.
All right, Diane, thank you very much for the question today. Dr. David Penn is our guest from New Vance Health. Number is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. When you have to go in and do surgery, either open or endoscopic, are you using, for lack of a better term, a scalpel, or are you using lasers these days?
So we don't use a lot of lasers in brain surgery, actually.
Why?
In general, the technology is such that what we want to do is work through the folds of the brain to access the tumor. Lasers sometimes can be destructive in some ways, so we want to work very carefully opening those various layers using a lot of very sharp instruments, right, so that things are cut very carefully. So lasers just haven't had a huge role in neurosurgery for one reason or another that I don't know if I fully understand why.
Okay. Well, I mean, I know I've heard from other doctors that at least in the old days, maybe not now, but it was tough telling the laser, okay, stop here. Don't go any further.
Sure. Right. So the idea in neurosurgery is we work carefully between these folds of the brain to access these tumors and kind of what you want to do is work all the way around it to physically remove it. Ultimately, we don't have great devices that can melt them away per se. Right?
Yeah.
So it's almost a, for lack of a better word, it's a physical removal. You have to remove that, and it can't just be, you know, vaporized or melted or kind of suctioned up.
So is that on the horizon?
Not that I know a whole lot about, unfortunately.
Dr. David Penn is our guest from New Vance Health Neurosurgery Today, 800-348-2551. Before our next call, you mentioned taking a picture of a brain, basically. MRI is still the gold standard for you guys?
MRI is still the gold standard. That gives us the best definition of the soft tissues in the brain. We often use CT scans. Those are very good for looking at the bone and very good for identifying bleeding that's occurred in the brain. But I would agree with you, the MRI is a gold standard.
Let's go to Stockbridge, Massachusetts, 800-348-2551. Mary, you're on.
Okay. Do I need to put the phone on speaker?
You sound pretty good. Generally speaking, okay, putting it on speaker is not, we want to go the opposite. Handset is better, but you sound great.
Okay. My 21-year-old granddaughter had surgery when she was 5 years old on a cranial pharyngioma tumor. So I'd like to hear Dr. Penn comment on that. They did have to remove her pituitary gland. So she has been on a daily injection, I'm not sure what, of what, and now she can self-inject. And her period was postponed, and so she's been on some kind of hormone replacement regimen ever since. Now she's pre-diabetic, and you know, I'm a little concerned about that. Apparently her hearing, she's had some hearing loss and some dental problems and a slight speech impediment. So there have been, you know, and I'm not sure how much of this has been, you know, effects of that surgery, but I just would like to hear Dr. Penn comment on the cranial pharyngioma.
So cranial pharyngiomas, while a relatively rare type of pituitary tumor, they're ultimately benign. But the challenge with those types of tumors is they can be more locally invasive. So they don't travel to other parts of the body like a cancer, so to speak, but they can be very invaded into the structures that they live around. And one of those structures in particular is the pituitary gland and the pituitary stalk. So oftentimes in order, especially in such a young child, you want to make sure that you get all of this tumor out. Because if you get it all out, in theory, you can offer the patient a cure from the disease. Now, unfortunately, in order to get them out, because it's so invaded into the pituitary gland, sometimes, as we were talking about earlier, you have to cut out the pituitary gland. And in particular, in a young child, that's more problematic than, say, an adult.
Because of growth, the effect of...
Exactly.
Okay.
It'll affect growth. It can affect puberty. Mm. It can affect all those things that an adult has already gone through.
Yeah.
Particularly in children, the situation that you're describing is exactly correct. You do your best to take out the tumor so that the patient doesn't have to worry about the tumor in the future. But then there's a lot of medical issues that you have to compensate for.
Deal with.
Right?
Yeah.
So all the hormone replacement, growth hormone replacement, sexual hormone replacement, all of those things.
Yeah.
So you know, it sounds like it's an unfortunate situation, obviously, but it sounds like they did everything they could, and you know, in order to help her have a normal life going forward, these are all things that they have to do. Now, the endocrine function can be so vast, some of her other issues may be related to not having those hormones all at the specific time that our genetics would just start it up, right? So the situation can certainly become more complicated with, as you mentioned, her menstrual cycle, her growth, her metabolism, all those kind of things. In my mind's eye, that's one of the things that I know. I'm a doctor, so it's a little different. Not what you want your granddaughter to have, right? But that's part of what makes pituitary tumors very interesting to me, is it's not just a unidimensional problem where there's the tumor, you take it out, and that's it. There's a lot of other thoughts that have to go into taking care of the entirety of the patient.
And I'm hoping she can have a normal life. I don't know if that means she could ever have children, for instance, or expect.
Okay. Well, Mary, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Dr. David Penn of New Vance Health is our guest today. And this email from Ken in Palmer, Massachusetts. I brought up the blood-brain barrier. And Ken wants to know, what is it about psychoactive drugs that gets them past the blood-brain barrier?
So usually it's what they dissolve in, right? So the cells that line our blood vessels, they have a lipid membrane. And essentially, to be able to pass that lipid membrane, molecules have to meet a couple criteria. One, they can be very, very small and slide between those molecules. Or two, they can dissolve in lipids. So if you think about when you combine oil and vinegar, right, one floats on top of the other. So if some of these psychoactive medications dissolve in fat or lipids, right, they can cross the blood-brain barrier without much difficulty. Or if they're very small, they can cross the blood-brain barrier without much difficulty. But if they don't meet those criteria, then it's hard to get them into the cells of the brain. And that's where a lot of our chemotherapies and cancer medications fall into. They're either too large or they don't dissolve in fats. So researchers are working on ways to combat that, because you still need the medication to do its job once it gets to where it needs to go. So you can't change it too drastically. And one thought process is changing the vehicle that allows it to cross those cells.
Dr. David Penn, our guest today, 800-348-2551 is the number here on Vox Pop. One more call before the next break. Let's go to Matamoros, Pennsylvania. Jim, you're on.
Is tree spining still used much anymore?
I'm sorry?
Say it again.
Is tree spining still used much anymore?
Tree finding? Explain.
Yeah.
Is that the right word, Jim? We're having trouble understanding you.
Drilling a hole in the skull.
Oh, trephination.
Aha.
Ah. Yes, actually, it's used quite commonly. Technically, trephination just means making a hole in the skull. So anytime we take out a brain tumor, drain a blood clot, we are using that. We're not doing it in the same sense that the ancient Egyptians were doing it, removing humors and things like that. We're doing it probably a little more advanced. But
Did the ancient Egyptians have any success doing brain surgery, or did they just wing it? Here's a drill. Let's go for it.
I got to imagine they were winging some things because they didn't have an MRI.
No, I guess not. All right. Maybe on the Ancient Alien show, we'll find out they actually did have an MRI. Hey, Zach, the engineer, let's take a break here. 800-348-2551 is the number. VoxPop at WAMC.org is the email address. Dr. David Penn, home stretch, straight ahead. Medical Monday. That's Tony Levin and Pete Levin together. Beautiful music. 800-348-2551 is our number. Dr. David Penn of New Vance Health is our guest today. And let's go back to our phone lines. We'll go to Wilton, New York. Susan, you're up.
Hi, Dr. Penn. I had a question about pituitary tumors. About 20 years ago, I was diagnosed with Graves' disease, and then about 6 or 7 years ago, they discovered I also have a microadenoma, about a three millimeter tumor, and they've been monitoring that. I'm just wondering, how do they determine at what point you would consider removing a microadenoma?
Sure, that's a great question. So ultimately, what really matters is the types of symptoms that you're having related to this tumor. Some studies actually show that probably about 10 to 12% of the population will have a pituitary lesion, either a cyst or a small adenoma like you're talking about, that we find by accident. So if it's small, if it's not causing you any symptoms, if it's not putting any pressure on surrounding structures, if it's not over-secreting hormones, those would all be situations where we would just keep an eye on it, often getting serial MRIs every year. Sometimes if we've followed it long enough and it really hasn't changed, we might space those MRIs out to every 2 years, every 5 years, and then eventually decide maybe we'll just wait till it causes something that we might need a new picture to see if something's changed. But certainly a situation like you're describing is one where probably best to just keep an eye on it and not go through the risks of a major surgery.
So if it's small enough, you basically, and it's not causing major symptoms, you would just leave well enough alone.
Correct. And again, as we spoke about earlier, these are not cancerous, so unlikely to go to the liver or the lungs or anything like that. And even at autopsy, by the way, there have been autopsy studies that have showed that 20 to 25% of the population will have some sort of pituitary lesion that never came up.
Wow.
Right? Exactly. They passed away from some completely unrelated reason.
All right, Susan.
Thank you so much.
Susan, I thank you. 800-348-2551 is our number. Now, if you remove the pituitary, if you have to remove the pituitary gland altogether, I assume that you will be on, the patient that is, will be on medications forever. When they remove the thyroid, you're on thyroid meds forever. So what meds do you have to be on? What hormones do you have to take when the pituitary comes out?
So the real important ones are actually, as you've already alluded to, thyroid medication and our body's internal steroids. So we would replace that hormone as well. Sometimes those patients will also need a medication that helps control their salt and water balance. People can develop a condition called diabetes insipidus, which means they're going to the bathroom a lot because the hormone that prevents us from going to the bathroom is released by the pituitary gland. So oftentimes, if you remove the entirety of the gland, those are the three medications you would absolutely need to replace if the patient's already gone through puberty and all those other things.
Our guest today is Dr. David Penn of New Vance Health. The number here is 800-348-2551. To Poughkeepsie. Andrew, you're on.
Hello, Dr. David. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question. I was involved in a car accident. It was really bad. I had a traumatic brain injury. I was in a coma for 16 days. No brain bleeding. So I basically have everything back now.
That's great.
Except some, you know, I have a small memory issues, but not that much different from your normal person. But I was wondering, like, what do I have to worry about anything later in life, like memory issues, dementia, Alzheimer's? Am I at an increased risk for something like that? Or basically, is the brain like a muscle? It can heal itself and be normal again?
That's a great question. So usually what I tell my patients who are involved in various traumatic brain injuries, you read a lot, especially with the NFL, you read a lot about chronic traumatic brain injuries. So if you're not getting hit, if you're not playing linebacker for the New York Giants, you know, usually this is hopefully a one-time event, and whatever injuries may have occurred will occur, and you won't develop kind of that summation of constantly getting hit in the head. So no, I wouldn't say that you're at increased risk if you're not continuously getting hit in the head. Unfortunately, some of those deficits or problems that you might have noticed immediately after the accident, they may never get 100% better, unfortunately. But I think the good news with you is it sounds like you're doing, you know, you had a bad accident and it sounds like you're doing very well. And hopefully things will only continue to get better and shouldn't necessarily, you know, you shouldn't necessarily jump off a cliff, so to speak, in terms of your brain function.
Right.
As long as you're not getting hit in the head constantly.
And really don't jump off a cliff.
Correct.
I won't.
All right, man. Thanks
for the call. Thank you so much. That gives me a lot of peace and comfort knowing I'm not going to get Alzheimer's and dementia for sure now.
Well, I mean, not to be a wet blanket, but you could still get it, but it may not be because of that.
Correct.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
All right. Thank you so much. Sorry to bring you down, brother. Yep. Appreciate it. Now, what happens in the head, inside the skull, when we get a concussion?
Sure. So the brain floats in a bath of fluid, spinal fluid.
Yeah.
It's the same that's connected to the back. And when the head moves, the brain will move at a different rate. So what can happen is you hit your head and the brain can bang up against the skull and you get, like every other tissue in your body, on your leg, you get a bruise on that brain. And oftentimes what will happen is the body recovers it. Now, what they've seen with some of these chronic head injuries is that over time, as you continue to bang up the brain, you can develop these proteins that can deposit in there and affect our brain's function.
Mm.
So in general, I try to advise people, you know, you get a single concussion, it doesn't mean that you're going to wind up like you're reading about on the news.
Yeah.
So we certainly want to avoid concussion after concussion after concussion. But that doesn't mean that if you hit your head hard enough, you can cause some permanent damage.
Dr. David Penn is with us today from New Vance Health. Let's go to West Sand Lake, New York. And how do I say your first name?
Challen?
Or is it?
Challen. C-H-A-L-L-E-N.
Gotcha. Challen, welcome to the show. You're on.
Thank you. I had a resection of a benign acoustic neuroma 6 years ago. And I guess I'm just curious about the logistics of how the surgery was done, because there was a neurosurgeon there and also an ear surgeon.
Yep.
And so I guess I'm just curious about the role of each of the surgeons in that procedure.
Sure.
And including, apparently, when they went in through the bone, they filled the hole up afterwards with some fat from my belly. Mm-hmm. And I've always been curious about that. But I realize that's a secondary question.
Sure. Very common scenario, for what it's worth. So in a lot of those types of tumors, a ENT or an otolaryngologist and a neurosurgeon will work together. And a little bit of it involves what we're really trained to do. So the neurosurgeon in general is very good at working around the brain and working around the nerves that come from the brainstem where this tumor grows off of. It grows off of one of the balance nerves. And these nerves travel through a small tunnel of bone in our temporal bone. And what the ear doctors are very good at is drilling out that bone to give the neurosurgeon access to take out the tumor.
Wow.
So the ear doctors are, in some ways, they help us get access to the tumor, and usually the neurosurgeon will take out the majority of the tumor. The downside with drilling through the temporal bone is that it creates a lot of access points for leakage of spinal fluid. We have to open that protective layer of the brain. And when that spinal fluid can communicate with areas of bone that track out through the ear or track out through the nose, you can get leakage of spinal fluid from those directions. And oftentimes, what we found, one of the best ways to plug up those holes is with a piece of fat from the belly. Huh. So we take the fat from the belly and we kind of lay it down along the bone that's been removed. And over time, what will happen is the fat will scar in and prevent leakage of
that
fluid.
So you will not have to do that more than once? You won't have to, it's a couple of years, we got to throw some more fat in there?
Correct. If it's done successfully, only once.
Amazing. Challen, you want to follow up? You good?
No, I guess it's interesting because I thought I had reversed the role of each of your surgeons and how much, well, who did what. And so that's it. So
okay.
Thank you. It's been very helpful. Appreciate it.
Thanks. Okay. You're welcome. Appreciate it. And let's go to Saratoga Springs. Mary Jo, it's your turn.
Hi, Dr. and Ray. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I had a removal of a cerebellar astrocytoma when I was a kid, probably before either of you were born. And I'm wondering if the doctor has anything to say about cerebellar tremors and what possibly I can do to sort of like control it.
Mm. Unfortunately, the cerebellum controls a lot of our coordination. So do you notice your tremors, say, when you're doing an activity, like if you're reaching for a glass, it's hard to control to do that activity smoothly? Is that what you notice?
Absolutely, doctor. Yes. Mm-hmm.
So unfortunately, that can be some damage to the brain in our coordination and balance function. One of the big things that the cerebellum participates in is allowing us to make smooth motions. Right. So there's feedback between the brain and your arm that allows you to reach out and grab a glass very smoothly and bring it to your lips. And when some of those feedback mechanisms get a little bit damaged from something, again, like you've alluded to, an astrocytoma or something that lives in that part of the brain, you can have permanent deficits. Usually what I recommend to my patients who have had these kind of problems after a surgery, sometimes occupational therapy can be very helpful. You know, if this is something that you've noticed since the time of the surgery, it might not mean that we can reverse it, but there might be ways we can help you compensate for it.
Okay, Mary Jo, can I just follow up for just a second while you're still here?
Sure, Ray. Go ahead.
Okay, so maybe some damage to the brain, mm-hmm, causing these tremors. But then you say occupational therapy may help. But if your brain isn't giving you the information, how is occupational therapy going to help in that case?
Sometimes they can help you compensate, number one. So you learn how to deal with that problem in such a way that it's not as disruptive to your life.
Yeah.
And sometimes there are, you know, various maneuvers or ways that they're a little more familiar with that can say, all right, if maybe if you brace your elbow like this, you can reach out and do something differently, more or less techniques, as opposed to completely changing the way the brain is wired.
So you're compensating physically.
Yeah.
All right, Mary Jo, I'm sorry to take your time. Do you want to go follow up on your own now?
I do. I just want to say that, you know, creating the brain can create other pathways, so I've been told, you know, to get that signal to behave or to go down a pathway that will allow you to reach out for that glass or whatever more smoothly. I think that is correct, right?
Very true. No? Certainly we call it plasticity, capability for plasticity is greater closer to the time of the injury.
So that's rewiring, basically.
Rewiring, yes, rewiring. Great
right.
term.
Right.
As you get further and further out, it becomes harder for the brain to completely rewire.
Mary Jo, thanks a lot for the call. Appreciate it. This rewiring business always fascinates me, and I think you and I have talked about this before on this show. Is there an age? Now, Mary Jo said she was older than me, which I highly doubt. But is there an age where that ability of your brain stops? If you have a major injury, is your brain going to rewire at a certain, stop doing it at a certain time?
I don't think there's ever a true age where it truly stops. But we definitely know that the younger you are, the better your plasticity is.
Oh, I'm in trouble. All right, let's go to East Hampton. And Barbara, you're on.
Oh, hi. Thanks, Greg Ray.
Hi.
Dr. Penn, is there anything on the horizon in medication for people with meningiomas? I have a meningioma, and I've had it since, I don't know how long, but treated with MRIs since 2010. And I have no plans to do anything more than that because I'm almost 90 years old.
All right, before...
So, go ahead, Barbara. Wondering about this.
All right, now...
Can you tell me anything?
Quickly, just tell me what a meningioma is.
A meningioma is another type of benign brain tumor
okay.
that grows from the protective layer of the brain,
all right.
not from the brain itself. So the good news is, again, this is a benign tumor, unlikely to go to the liver or the lungs or anything like that. Unfortunately, we don't have a medication out there that we can use to treat these, but it actually is the most common brain tumor that we see. And similar to pituitary tumors, if it's not causing you any symptoms, if it's not putting excessive pressure on the brain, things like that, this is another type of tumor that we will often just watch with serial MRIs. It's common. It's about 30% of the population has one. Sometimes they can be very small, but sometimes they can grow large and cause symptoms. If we were to develop a medication, depending on the side effects of that medication, this might be a type of tumor that the risks of the medication may still outweigh the risks of the tumor. So no, the long and short answer to your question is no, we don't have a medication out there yet that we're using to treat these. But the good news is, again, these are benign tumors, and if they're asymptomatic, they don't require a surgery.
All right, Barbara, thanks. Now we have 90 seconds left with Dr. David Penn, and let's go to New Baltimore. Lou, you're on. Lou.
Yeah, hi, gents. Does the brain have a separate and a specialized endocrine system while you sleep?
So that's a great question, actually. The brain has a gland in the back of the brain, not the pituitary gland, the pineal gland. It's a different gland that secretes something called melatonin that controls our circadian rhythms. So while that's not controlling your metabolism, your growth, all those kind of things, the brain does have an endocrine function that helps regulate when you sleep and when you're awake.
Interesting. Well, I'll leave it there. This pineal gland, if you lose that, what do you do?
That's another thing that we can replace. Melatonin is a common medication.
That's all it makes is melatonin?
That's all it makes, melatonin.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. And how many of those surgeries do you do a year?
Those are much more rare.
Yeah.
Tumors of the pineal gland are very infrequent, fortunately. People can have cysts in their pineal gland, but in general, those are benign and don't require surgery. So pineal surgery is somewhat uncommon.
Dr. David Penn, we are just about out of time. You any surgeries today? You got to go race back?
Fortunately, not today, but tomorrow should be a busy day.
All right, man. Hey, thanks for being here, and we'll, I presume, see you in 2025, yeah?
Sounds perfect.
All right. Support comes from the VNA and Hospice of the Southwest Region, providing home health and hospice care since 1946 throughout Bennington, Franklin, and Rutland counties, VermontVisitingNurses.org. Thanks again to Dr. David Penn of New Vance Health for being here today. Thank you for listening. Great calls, great emails, much appreciated. Thanks to Bob Rathbun, doing a good job there screening the calls there, Bobby. Good job. Zach Malloy is on the phone, but thank you, Zach. Appreciate your work at the controls. Tomorrow, okay, we do this twice a year. We'll talk genealogy with Tracy Scrabbit, who comes all the way from Boston for this show. We'll see you tomorrow at 2:00.